life in her hands more than once. He had believed she could save Eleanor, and he had known she would come back for him if she could. He trusted her, wayward and restless and frivolous though she was. She would never betray him. "I suppose she is," he said at last, and he saw Eleanor relax, pleased with his answer. He smiled at her. "And I guess that makes Donald and Cammon my brothers, if you think of them that way." "They can be my brothers," he decided. "And Taze, too?" That required no cogitation. He said, "Taze is my father." They arrived at the Alloa homestead in the middle of the afternoon on a sunny but absolutely frigid day. Justin was rapidly taking in details. There were about 10 buildings on this roughly defined property, all of them solidly built of wood, some quite large. About half of them sported chimneys that were curling with smoke, so those must be houses where people lived. The others would be barns or sheds. There was a small, well-kept area in the center that appeared to be shared space. It featured two wells, a chopping block, some tools, and a cart. "Which house is yours?" he asked Eleanor, and she pointed at the largest one, 2.5 stories high, with brightly painted shutters on the windows. "Do we just go right in?"
"I've brought home a visitor," she said. "I need to announce you."
She slipped from the horse, so he dismounted quickly and followed her to a hammered gong that hung from a metal frame.
"Two strokes means company," she said, picking up a mallet that rested against the frame.
"How many strokes means danger?" she smiled.
"5. You would think of that."
"You always have to be prepared for trouble." She gave him a sideways look.
"Maybe I should strike the gong 5 times now," he grinned.
"No. I'm going to be very well behaved." She hit the gong twice, and it sent out lovely but urgent notes that Justin guessed could be heard even some distance off the property, especially if he were trained to listen for the sound. The hammered metal hadn't quite stopped quivering on its chains when the first doors opened and figures came streaming out. Justin took a deep breath and planted his feet, bracing himself. But Eleanor dropped the mallet and flung her arms out and ran straight toward one of the women racing from the big house. In seconds, she was enveloped by a shouting, crying, laughing crowd, children, men, women, dogs, and everyone was hugging her and everyone was repeating her name. This, Justin supposed, was what it was like to belong to a family. Torin had appointed himself Justin's guide and guardian and nemesis. It was clear nothing was going to induce him to leave Justin's side. Hayden and a rotating cast of cousins joined them at various points, for meals, for discussions, for tricky competitive games, but none of them stuck as close as Torin. Justin was even bedded down in Torin's room, on a mattress on the floor that was far more comfortable than he would have expected. 3 days after their arrival, no one had offered to kill him, and so Justin thought the visit with the Sabata was going fairly well.
"Now, here's a game I bet you're good at," Torin said.
Half a dozen of them were lounging in a small open area in the middle of a barn that housed probably 20 cows. They'd spent much of their time there since Justin's arrival. The space was cluttered with tools and broken chairs and partial bales of hay, but the body heat of the cattle kept the place relatively warm. It was a good place to retreat from the interference of women. Justin looked over, keeping his face impassive. This was yet another test, as all the other games had been. Oh, certainly they had all been played for the sake of entertainment, or would have been on any ordinary day, but their real value had been the chance to gauge Justin's reflexes and coordination. So far, he'd managed well enough, even when he couldn't exactly comprehend the rules, because he'd understood the one great overriding rule, make a show of strength. It was not, after all, that different from running a gang of thieves on the streets of Gosenhall and constantly proving you were so tough that no one wanted to challenge you.
"What kind of game?"
he said. One of the cousins, Errol, Justin thought, was bringing out a wooden case filled with some kind of jangling cargo. He knelt in the middle of the floor and opened it to reveal a collection of rings of various sizes, all made of metal. Errol gave Torin an unsmiling look. He was a strange one, Justin thought. Tall, slim, and silent, more standoffish than the rest of the noisy cousins. He often wore an abstracted expression, as though his thoughts were far from this place and these people, and he hadn't bothered participating in most of the contests. He'd won the ones he did play, though. He was supple and fast, and behind his dreamy eyes was a quick intelligence. Justin thought he was probably more dangerous than Torin, though Torin was clearly the one all the other cousins admired most.
"Hooptos," Errol said.
"What's that?" Justin asked.
Torin was pulling the rings out and lobbing them to the other players in the barn, reserving a pile of the smallest ones for himself.
"We throw the hoops in the air. You catch them on your sword. The more you catch, the more points you win. The smallest ones are the hardest to capture," he added.
Justin didn't move.
"I don't nick up my sword with game pieces," he said. Not that his own weapon was currently hanging at his belt. It had been given over to Torin's keeping the evening they arrived.
Torin looked impatient.
"No, of course you don't," he said. "We use old ones that have been discarded. There ought to be three of them back here in the barn. You can pick the one that feels best in your hand."
By the bright mother's weeping red eye, Justin thought, following Torin to a corner of the room, this man will be competing with me to the day I die. The three swords were indeed fairly battered, and two of the blades were bent out of true, but the third one was in reasonably good shape, though lighter weight than the weapon Justin carried on a regular basis. That might be good, he thought, whipping the blade through the air just to get a sense of its reach and heft. If he was going to use it to pluck objects from the air...
"Where do I stand?" he asked.
They pushed him to the center of the open space, then stood around him. It turned out any of them could throw a ring in the air at any time from any direction, the only stipulation being that it had to rise high enough to afford him a reasonable chance to catch it. They all agreed on the lower edge of the window set in the pointed slope of the barn's upper story. Justin positioned himself, raised his sword, and nodded at Torin. Instantly, he was in the middle of a hailstorm of metal rings, and he dashed from side to side, spearing them from the air. One or two hit him on the back or shoulder, more than a few fell with a thud to the wooden floor. But he caught a good number, and they rattled against the hilt as he lunged for another one and another. When all the hoops had been disposed of, he had 11 hanging from his blade. Another 20 or so dotted the floor. He didn't think it was a bad showing for his first attempt to play. Then again, he was always going to fare well at any activity that allowed him to have a sword in his hand.
"Good game," he said, tilting his blade down so the hoop slid off in a musical clatter. "Do I do it again, or is it someone else's turn?"
No one bothered to tell him if he'd done well or poorly. Torin held up his hand, and Justin passed him the sword.
"Pick up about 6 rings,"
Torin directed. Justin joined the others in gathering the hoops from the floor. Then they all made a circle around Torin.
"Go," the young man said, and the rings went flying.
By the time all motion ceased, Torin had collected 5 rings. He looked disgusted, but didn't bother to swear or complain, just handed the sword to his brother. Hayden only managed to pluck 3 rings out of the air. 2 of the other cousins caught 6 apiece. Errol, who went last and therefore was clearly their best player, snagged 9. Justin began to think that his own performance had been nothing short of spectacular.
"What's the usual score at hoop toss?" he asked when Errol had emptied his sword.
5 or 6 is about average. Better than 7, and you're among the best," Hayden said.
Justin arched his eyebrows. No one had complimented him on his own achievement.
Maybe they all thought he'd just been lucky.
Huh. Wonder how well I'd do on a second try, he said.
Errol turned smoothly and handed him the sword.
I was wondering the same thing, he said in his smoky voice.
Justin stepped to the center again and waited for them to gather up the rings.
Go,
he said, and the air was filled with a flock of flying metal. He stabbed, whirled, stabbed again, convinced that this time the others were releasing all the targets even faster. But when the last ring hit the floor and rolled to the side of the room, Justin had 12 hoops dangling from the blade. He knew better than to gloat or preen.
Must be my kind of game, was all he said. I've always been handy with a sword.
So have I, Errol replied. But you must be remarkable.
Justin shrugged and tilted the blade down, watching all the rings pile up on the floor. Eleanor had been right. Before this visit was over, someone was going to challenge him to a duel. That it was likely to be a mock battle, with all participants still alive at the end, didn't mean it wasn't going to be fierce and deadly serious.
Some people try to be good at a lot of things, he said. Some people pick one. I picked one, and that's it.
Torin chucked a ring at him, no force behind the throw, and Justin grabbed it with his hand.
I'm guessing there are one or two other things you're pretty good at, Torin said.
Justin allowed himself a small smile.
If they have something to do with fighting, probably.
Hayden glanced at Torin.
My sister says you've been injured recently, the younger man said. Probably wouldn't want to wrestle.
Now Justin had to smother a laugh. Had she been trying to protect him, or was she truly worried about his health?
I'm about healed, he said. I can show you the scars.
That elicited a quick interest from everyone present, so he pulled his shirt up over his head. The silence that followed was profound, and he knew they weren't just cataloging the fresh wounds, still red enough to look angry. They were reading the history of his life, carved into his chest and back and shoulders. It was a fairly detailed and mostly ugly tale. He resettled the shirt and shook his hair back. He should have had Eleanor cut it before they arrived. He was starting to look as shaggy as Cammon.
I could fight if I had to, he said. But I don't know that I want to wrestle just yet, just for fun.
No, Hayden said.
Well, Eleanor told us we couldn't even ask you to.
They all laughed at that, as if women's words carried any weight. Errol knelt on the floor and began returning the hoops to the wooden case.
Almost dinner, Torin said suddenly. Let's go back to the house.
Chapter 43 The only times Justin had been allowed to see Eleanor in the past 3 days had been at meals, and so he looked forward to them with more than the usual anticipation. Tonight it was a little hard to find her, since the ranks of family had swelled by another 15 or 20, new arrivals who'd come in while he was showing off for the young men, Justin supposed. Tables had been set up in the large dining room that opened into an equally large sitting room, and there was room for about 60 people to sit together in one more or less continuous space. Surely that many were gathered there now, clusters of adults talking with great animation, packs of children running and screaming around the chairs, chaotic and noisy, but everyone seemed happy, glad to be together. And the food smelled wonderful. Justin spotted Eleanor waving at him from the main table in the primary room, and he worked his way through the crowd, nodding politely. Everyone stared at him, knowing him not only for a stranger, but for the stranger who was the reason they had all convened. The younger girls smiled and ducked their heads. Any man under the age of 30 watched him with a measuring eye. The older women assessed him, too, but for different reasons, he thought. Will he be kind to Eleanor? Can he be trusted? For what reasons did he win our girl's heart? He finally reached Eleanor's side and surreptitiously put his hands on her waist, kissing the top of her head.
Sit,
she said, and pushed him into a chair. I have to help serve.
Did you cook, too? I don't know what I'm smelling, but I can't wait to eat it.
She smiled, pleased. Her face was flushed with heat from the kitchens. She was wearing a simple gown set off with a beautiful collar of black opals. All the women wore similar gems on their hands or around their wrists, Justin had noticed, and a few of the men wore heavy rings set with the same kind of stone. Seneth had once said the folk of the Lirans wore black opals to honor the Dark Watcher. Eleanor had resumed hers as soon as she stepped back inside this house.
I helped with some of the meal, she admitted. Sit. I'll be back.
It took a while, but eventually every table was laden with tureens and baskets and serving plates, and every chair was occupied. The dishes were passed around from hand to hand, and there was much talk and laughter among tables and between rooms. Justin filled his plate, ate every scrap on it, and filled it again.
What's in this bread? He demanded of Eleanor, taking his fourth piece as a basket passed his way again.
Isn't that good? It's the salt bread I told you about.
There's more in it than salt, he said emphatically.
She laughed.
It's feast bread, only made for special occasions.
He watched her as he chewed and swallowed. Am I a special occasion?
Well, she said demurely, we are.
Her attention was briefly claimed by the woman on her right, but she soon turned back to Justin.
So, what did you do to amuse yourself while I was working hard in the kitchens?
He grinned.
What have I done every day? Proved myself to your brothers and your cousins.
She rolled her eyes.
What was it today?
Hoop toss. Ever play?
No, I've watched it, though. Errol's usually the best.
Justin nodded.
He was pretty good.
She waited, but finally had to ask,
So, how did you score?
He grinned.
Better than Errol.
She looked pleased.
Really? That must have impressed Torin.
Oh, I think it did.
He glanced away from her to scan the tables. He eventually found Errol, seated deep in the heart of the adjoining room, carrying on what looked like an intense conversation with an older man.
The one who impressed me was Errol.
Eleanor glanced straight at her cousin, as if she had known exactly where he was sitting. In fact, she probably had. She probably could close her eyes right now and recite exactly who had taken what place at every table. She was linked to these family members the way Justin was linked to Seneth and Taze and his circle of friends. He could almost feel the bonds between them, thick and tangible as woven rope.
He's always been one of my favorites, she said softly. But he's grown so quiet lately.
Justin tore a fifth piece of bread between his hands.
Why? What happened?
Oh, the woman he loved declared herself Bata Lo and went to live in Gilengaria. In Gosenhall, in fact.
Justin shrugged.
He could follow her, maybe. Join the royal army, settle down with her somewhere in the city?
I don't think so, Eleanor said dryly. She's married to the king.
Justin almost choked on his bread. He grabbed his glass and gulped down half of his wine.
Errol is in love with Queen Valerie? Valerie is a Lirin girl? Are you sure?
She looked surprised.
Well, of course I'm sure. Everyone knows it.
No one I'm acquainted with knows it.
She looked at him helplessly for a moment.
That's right, I keep forgetting. The people of Gilengaria have no understanding of our customs. You probably never even noticed the patterns in her hair, or knew what they meant if you saw them.
He thought rapidly, conjuring up an image of the young, beautiful, and wholly mysterious queen. She had flawless white skin, eerie green eyes, and lustrous but very short black hair.
She doesn't have patterns, he said. Her hair is only down to here.
He brushed a finger along Eleanor's jaw.
She cut her hair off?
Eleanor sounded distressed.
Maybe. I suppose she didn't want anyone to know who she was then. I don't know why.
Probably because the noble folk of the 12 houses would not think so highly of the king marrying a Lirin girl, Justin said. I'm sure they all think she's from some minor branch of a respectable house."
Eleanor looked affronted. "The Lirin folk are respectable," he laughed at her.
"Perfectly. But the Marlords and Marladies have strange ideas about class and station."
He took another, more meditative sip of his wine.
"I wonder if Sinith knows," he said, "about Valerie. I don't think she does. She seems as baffled by the Queen as everyone else is."
"Then maybe you shouldn't tell her, or Taze," Eleanor said. "If Valerie doesn't want anyone to know..." He just looked down at her a moment, trying to decide what to say.
"I'm not used to keeping secrets from Taze," he said at last. "But I'll try."
The woman next to Eleanor tugged on Eleanor's sleeve again, and the man beside Justin began to ask him about travel through Gilengaria, so they lost their opportunity for private conversation. Soon enough, all talk ceased, as Eleanor's father stood up and clapped his hands for silence. He was lean and wiry and dark-haired as his daughter. Justin had not spent much time alone with him over these past few days, but he judged the man to be an older, somewhat more thoughtful version of Torin.
"Some of you have traveled far, and all of you have traveled happily to join our family at this time," Winlow began. "It seems we will be celebrating a wedding. All of you know my daughter Eleanor, of course, but let me introduce the man she is to marry. Justin, stand up."
He came to his feet, drawing himself up straight and keeping his face entirely solemn. Cammon would call that his intimidating look, but in truth he was covering a certain unease. He was never comfortable speaking in front of a crowd. He made a small nod to the assembled group and stood until Winlow motioned him to resume his seat.
"A man from Gilengaria," Winlow continued, "but my sons and I have accepted him, and we expect you to do the same." "What is his station?" someone called out,
an older man, maybe one of Winlow's brothers.
"He is a soldier in service to the king," Winlow replied. "An honorable position."
"How did he meet Eleanor?" a woman asked.
Winlow glanced at Eleanor, who answered, "Most of you know my family sent me to the Luminan Convent to be with my cousin Rosary." There was a low murmur of anger, outrage, and dismay, heartfelt for all that it was quickly subdued. Everyone here had heard Rosary's story by now, Justin supposed. Eleanor continued, "I was walking on the streets of Neft, a small town very close to the convent, and a drunken man took me in his arms. Justin came to my rescue." The crowd's response to that was far more favorable. Winlow took his seat again. Justin guessed that meant he and Eleanor would be fielding the rest of the questions.
"Did you think he was handsome?"
one of the little girls called, and then dissolved into giggles.
"I did," Eleanor said with a smile. "Don't you think so?"
"How long have you been in service to the king?"
a young man asked.
"I have been a king's rider nearly 8 years," Justin replied.
"And it pays well?"
"I am not as rich as the king, but I can support a wife," Justin answered, and that earned a laugh.
"What did you like about Eleanor?"
another girl wanted to know. Justin grinned.
"You mean before she saved my life? Because I liked that a great deal."
That elicited a flurry of questions and exclamations. "She saved your life? What happened? Were you ill? When did this occur?"
"I had gone to visit Eleanor at the convent, but novices were not allowed to meet with men from the outside world," Justin said soberly.
He had realized days ago that this story would work in his favor, though he hadn't expected to have such a public chance to recount it. But the Lirin men liked any recitation that had to do with battle and bloodshed.
"Some of the convent guards followed me home and attacked me on the road. Eleanor was worried about me, and she came after me, and found me almost dead."
"How many guards?"
Predictably, Torin was the one who wanted to know.
5.
There was a moment's silence at that.
"And Eleanor saved you?"
her mother asked softly.
"For the Great Mother has gifted her with a tremendous healing power."
She did indeed bring me back from the brink of death.
He glanced at Eleanor, who was looking pale. She didn't like to be reminded of his close brush with mortality.
But I had fallen in love with her before that day, for her smile and her kindness, and for the way she made me feel.
He put a hand to his heart, and there was a sound of sighing approval from the women.
"So you live in Goson Hall?" someone said. "Yes. Tell us about your family."
This was it. This was the tricky moment. This was the answer that would define him in their eyes. He had considered what to say, but he hadn't rehearsed the words. He spoke slowly, as if remembering it all as he went along.
"I have two families. My mother was a farm girl from the Storian lands, orphaned after some plague, living with neighbors who didn't care for her much and didn't have much notion of charity. When she was 16, she headed to Goson Hall, thinking she could find work in the royal city. Well, there's not much work suited for a young girl with no skills and no friends. What would you expect? She was pretty enough, and a man offered to pay her to take her to bed. She stayed with him a few months till he got bored and left, and she found another man. And another."
The silence in the room was absolute. He could not tell if Eleanor's assembled relatives were horrified, repulsed, or saddened.
"Eventually, she found a house of other women who sold themselves by the day or the hour, a place of filth and stench and rats. She bore four children, a hazard of the job. I was the fourth, and the only boy. My sisters were all gone before they turned 14. I haven't seen any of them since. I have no idea if they live, and, if they live, what they do. My mother died the year that I was 10.
He thought Eleanor's mother was weeping. Eleanor herself seemed on the verge of tears. She knew the story, but not the details. He was keeping his voice calm, because in reality he felt no strong emotion, no outrage, no shame, no anger. It had been his life. It had been all he knew. Not until he left it did he find himself marveling that he survived it.
"I left the brothel and lived on the streets," he continued. "Even then I was strong and I knew how to fight. I made friends, boys just like me, and we patrolled the alleys at night looking for easy prey. We robbed, we stole, we quarreled. One night, I assaulted a rich man and took his wallet and his sword, taught myself how to use it. I'd always been good with a dagger, but I liked the long blade better. There was a crazy old man who lived in the sewers and claimed to have been a fencing master in Arborhearst. He gave me lessons that I still remember today. I'd been living on the streets 3 years, a long time for a boy like me to survive, when I picked the wrong man to attack. He was big, but I thought he looked slow and I didn't see any weapons on him. I tried to rob him, but he pulled a dagger and put up a real fight. He was so good. It wasn't long before I knew he could kill me, and I thought he would. When I slipped and he had me helpless, I waited for his blade to come down, but he sheathed his dagger and pulled me to my feet and told me he wanted to train me for the King's Guard.
That caused another murmur in the crowd, this one of interest and approval. Anything to change the bleak tone of the earlier confessions, he thought. He glanced down at Eleanor, who was watching him with a face filled with pain. He smiled.
"That was Taze," he told her, loud enough for everyone else to hear. "He took me back to the palace. He made sure I received the best training available. And when I was good enough, he nominated me to be a king's rider."
He swept the rest of the tables with a glance.
"The king's riders are the best of the best, the fastest, strongest, and most loyal fighters in the king's army. Baron chooses each one himself and would trust any one of us with his life. A king's rider can walk into any room in the palace at any time, night or day, and be admitted into the presence of royalty. If a rider makes a statement, the king knows it is true. A rider has more than skill. He has courage and honor. He would die for his king. There are 50 riders, mostly men, a few women, and they became my second family, Justin went on. They didn't just teach me more about how to fight. They taught me how to live. They taught me about the sort of strength that does not come from the body. They watched over me. They corrected me when I was wrong. They praised me when I was right. And they made me understand what it meant to belong. I know that if at any time I were to cry out for help, 49 brothers and sisters would come to my aid. Eleanor had been right after all, he thought. He knew exactly when he should present his bride gift. He reached into the pocket of his shirt, where he kept Seneth's gold chain, and he pulled it out so that the charm dangled loose for everyone to see. 2 weeks ago, Taze married a woman named Seneth, who is kin with the Purcell family, he said. In some way I cannot explain, she is also kin to me, though we are not related by blood and we have not formally adopted each other. But she is as close to me as family. Her own tale is as strange as mine, for she left home when she was very young. Her grandmother handed her this pendant as Seneth was walking out the door, a reminder that love still existed, even in a harsh and careless world. Seneth gave the necklace to me, and I give it to Eleanor as my bride gift. He took Eleanor's hand and folded it over the loops of gold, then lifted her hand and pressed her knuckles to his lips. My family welcomes you, Eleanor, he whispered, and they love you as well as I do. I hope that you will very soon be my bride. It was a couple of hours before the commotion died down. Justin gauged how well his presentation had gone by the number of women at the tables who were sobbing. Wouldn't Kira laugh to think any speech of Justin's could reduce young women to tears? As for himself, he felt a little more raw than he had expected to, but he certainly wasn't on the verge of crying. Merely, he was not used to talking so long about such intensely personal feelings. He didn't think he'd want to be returning to the Lyrans all that often if emotions were always going to run so high. But the speech had signaled the end of dinner and the beginning of a dizzying round of congratulations. Eleanor's relatives, every last one of them, or so it seemed, came pressing up to Justin to take his hand and wish him well. Eleanor had been enveloped in her own crowd of well-wishers, mostly girls, but he watched her dark head as it bobbed in the sea of sisters and cousins and aunts. Several times she turned around to glance at him and always smiled to find half his attention given over to her. Once she laughed and blew him a kiss. He thought the aftermath of the evening would never come to an end. But slowly, the visitors dispersed and sifted out. Hoping that Eleanor was watching him, Justin slipped out the side door and stood in the garden, which was stripped and bare in the dead of winter but still decorated with a few wispy stalks. The moon was a full and perfect circle, though small and high, must be close to midnight. The still, frigid air was a welcome contrast to the heat and chatter inside the house. In less than a minute, Eleanor found him, coming up from behind and putting her arms around his waist. He turned to take her in a more proper embrace, shielding her from the night air, curious eyes, and any other hazard, small or calamitous, that might trip along to offer her menace.
"That seemed to go well," he said cautiously, in case he'd misread these Lyran folk and it hadn't.
"So very well," she murmured into his chest. "And all this time I've been planning how to comfort you when you stumbled through your presentation or didn't manage to find the right words."
He laughed. "Never was much of one for making speeches."
"Well, that's the last one you'll have to make for me." He kissed her.
"So, what next? When do we get to marry? When do I get to leave Torin's room and come to yours?"
She giggled, but even by moonlight he could tell her face heated up. Tomorrow, of course. The wedding breakfast is always the day after the groom presents the bride gift.
Why didn't you tell me that before? He exclaimed. I'd have flung the necklace over your head as we were riding up to your parents' house.
Because this was perfect, she whispered, lifting her mouth once again to be kissed. And tomorrow we will be married in the morning. A voice called to her from the kitchen. This was a family that knew better than to give courting couples too much time alone. And Eleanor sighed, kissed him again, and hurried back inside. Justin was too restless to re-enter the big house, climb the stairs to the room he shared with Torrin, and lie awake on his mattress, counting the hours till the morrow. His wedding day. He strolled out of the garden, through the central open area, and around the barn where the cows were gathered. He felt remarkably good, alive with sensation, excitement buzzing through his veins like the first taste of excellent wine. If there had been another rider nearby, Justin would have offered him a challenge, a little swordplay by moonlight. As it was, he considered taking off up the road at a run just to release some of his coiled energy. A footfall behind him. Surely deliberate, because these Lyran men could move without making a sound. And suddenly, Torrin was beside him.
"I met this Taze and this Seneth you spoke of," Torrin said.
Justin nodded.
"That's right, in Korivan. Seneth told me. She is kin. If he is married to her, that makes him kin as well. They are excellent fighters. They will bring honor to the Lyran folk."
Justin had to grin at that, but he answered solemnly,
"I think you can be proud to call them family. She mentioned that war could be coming to Gilengaria."
Justin nodded.
"Some of the noble houses see an old king on the throne and think they could rule better than his daughter when he dies. We think there are armies being raised in secret and rebels making alliances against the crown."
"The men of the Lyrans have no argument with any of your houses," Torrin said. "Heffel of Korivan says he will stay neutral if the rest of you fall into a war."
"I wish him luck in that," Justin said a little bitterly. "Sometimes it is harder to stay out of an argument than a man might think. Will you be fighting?"
Justin nodded again.
"All the riders will take the king's side, or his daughter's side, if war only comes once her father is dead. When you marry my sister, you will be kin. You will have the right to call on your brothers and cousins to join you in combat. Taze, too. You could both call on the Sabata Rhys."
Justin caught his breath. Seneth had not seemed to think it would be so easy. Seneth had also seemed to have grave reservations about embroiling the young men of the Lyrans in a war that could prove desperately bloody.
"The king's riders would be grateful to have their Lyran brothers fighting beside them," he said carefully. "But this isn't your war, and I don't want to be the one to ride back across the mountains to tell your women that you're dead. Anyone who freely chose to fight would be welcome, but I don't want to invoke the bonds of family, not when so much family could be lost."
"Speaking for myself, I like to fight," Torrin said and grinned.
Justin laughed silently.
"Somehow, I had guessed that."
Torrin's eyes were gleaming with mischief, even by moonlight.
"Seneth told me I would not be able to defeat you if I decided to duel you for my sister's honor."
"Well, she's never defeated me,"
Justin said, drawling the words. "You might have better luck."
"Of course, you were recently injured,"
Torrin said, as if offering an excuse. "You wouldn't want to duel so soon. Tonight, for instance. If you lost, you might say your wounds made you drop the sword, or wield it in a clumsy manner."
Now Justin had to laugh outright.
"I think I'm recovered enough to make a pretty good showing. Who do you think might want to challenge me?"
"Well," Torrin said, grinning broadly,
"I would."
"Tell me where my weapon is," Justin said, "and I'll be happy to match swords with you."
Torrin dropped his hands to his waist and began undoing his buckle. Justin realized that he was wearing two belts, two scabbards, two swords.
I brought it with me, Torrin said, in case you were interested in a duel.
Wordlessly, Justin accepted his belt from Torrin's hands and fastened it around his body, happy to feel the familiar weight at his hips, against his thigh. He drew the blade and held it up for an examination by the watery light of the moon. It didn't seem to have sustained any damage while under Torrin's care.
Just so I'm clear, Justin said, this is a friendly fight. No one dies.
Torrin laughed. He seemed bright with excitement, pleased at the notion of a quick clash by starlight, of measuring himself against someone he was unlikely to defeat. Justin was pretty sure he was better than the Lyran man, but he wasn't going to be stupid. For so many reasons, it was important to win this particular battle. Still, he liked this young man, liked his eagerness and his arrogance and stubbornness. What a rider he'd make, he thought. We'll have to bring him to Gosenhall.
No one dies, Torrin confirmed. No one is wounded either, except maybe for a scratch or two, insignificant.
Justin nodded. Then you're on. Raise your weapon. They swept their hands up at precisely the same moment, and then paused, with their swords upright, eyeing each other past the slim, glittering blades. Justin took a deep breath of the cold air and calmed his mind, steadied his nerves. They were alone out here, between the barns and the storage buildings, and yet he could not shake the thought that they had acquired an audience. The knight pressed against his back, as if someone had laid a cool hand upon his shoulder. The moon peered down through her single round eye. At least two of the goddesses were watching, curious to see how this contest turned out. Pleased rather than not to find Lyran folk making alliances with Gilengaria men. At least two of the goddesses had tracked Justin farther than he had ever roamed, despite the fact that he had never given any of them a moment's thought, the slightest pledge of honor. One had betrayed him, and one had succored him, and both of them were jealous for the attention of the women he loved. And so he would have to learn to understand them, to fit them somewhere within the contours of his life.
Where is the god of war? He wondered. Shouldn't he be here too, taking an interest in me? Or is he already watching? Has he been watching my whole life, caring for me, when I did not even realize he was nearby? Maybe all my luck was really some god's intervention. Maybe, like the mystics, I have always drawn my strength from some invisible source. Are you ready? Torrin asked.
I'm ready, Justin said.
He tightened his hand on his hilt, and he waited.
This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Supervising producer, Mike Charzik. Producer, Gail Hendricks. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2006 by Sharon Shin. Audio recording copyright 2008 by Audible Inc.
If you enjoyed Dark Moon Defender, you'll want to listen to another of Sharon Shin's 12 Houses novels, Reader and Railinx. Here's a special sneak preview.
Naturally, the rest of the luncheon was an awkward, rushed affair, strange and uncomfortable, even after the riders had carried off the imposter. Cammon could tell that all the Marlords and Marladies were relieved when it was over, and Valerie hurried Amelie out of the room as quickly as she could. Riders reappeared to escort Koshku into a private conference with the king, and Cammon was off duty. He was still in the kitchen, stuffing himself with leftover food, when Seneth came looking for him.
"Well done," she said, ruffling his hair. "The king has directed Milo to give you all sorts of rewards, bags of gold or some such thing. I told him to have it delivered to Gerald's."
Cammon was pleased, more by the praise than the money, because what use did he have for gold? He didn't own anything, and he didn't want anything either.
It seems he would be better off hiring me to protect him than Amelie. He considers Amelie more valuable. So is this going to happen again and again? Murderers sneaking into the city to try to kill the king?
Seneth sighed, glanced around, and pulled up a chair. He was sitting at the massive table in the middle of the enormous kitchen, and probably 20 cooks and scullery maids were scurrying around them, cleaning up the remains of the meal. Not the most private place to have a conversation. Still, by now, everyone in the palace compound, down to the youngest groom in the stables, knew there had been an attempt on the life of the king.
"I wouldn't be surprised," she said. "We have heard talk of war for a year now. If I were to guess, I would say Hakon Gizeltes and his allies are waiting for good weather before making an assault on the throne. They plan to take us into battle. But if they can kill Baron first, they will be that much closer to their goal. Then, like I said..."
She smiled.
"He has the riders to protect him. You need to watch over Amelie."
She glanced around the kitchen again.
"Actually, I thought you could watch over both of them. If you're living at the palace, you'll be able to sense anyone who comes in and out of the gates."
"Living at the palace? I thought..."
"I know. I've sent to Gerald for your things."
She took in his borrowed costume, and her smile widened.
"Though I don't know why I bothered. My guess is Milo will provide you with an entirely new wardrobe, since your own is so atrocious."
Cammon felt a certain excitement. What an honor, commanded to serve at the will of the king. And a certain disquiet. What if he failed? What if no one liked him? What if he embarrassed himself in the royalty he was set to serve? And what would Gerald and Lynette do, and Aurel, without him there? For he completed many of the harder physical chores, and his sunny disposition cheered their bleaker days. He didn't have to be a reader to know that. They had each told him so. They viewed him as a sort of favored nephew or grandson.
"Can I go back some days?" he said. "Just to visit?"
Seneth's face showed a good deal of comprehension.
"Of course. You won't be a prisoner here in the palace, and Gerald and the others will get along just fine without you. Why, you were gone for months last year, traveling around the country with me. How do you think they managed then?"
He grinned and ducked his head.
"I just wanted... It seemed..."
She ruffled his hair again.
"You've been abandoned so many times yourself that you hate to abandon anyone else," she said, though he had never told her that, not in so many words.
"I know. But this time, trust me, Cam, it's all right. Now come on, I'm supposed to take you to say hello to the princess."
Reader and Railings by Sharon Shin is available for download today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.